Talk. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The movement toward LGBTQ rights started 47 years ago this Wednesday, June 28, 1969, when riots broke out during a police raid at the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York City, which President Obama declared a national monument just last week. After that landmark event, many LGBT individuals still felt the need to remain invisible in a society that refused to accept them, even as they continued to work for that acceptance. A major step forward in the effort came as the result of a monumental decision a year ago this month when the Supreme Court issued their ruling on marriage equality. But as events in Orlando recently demonstrated, total acceptance remains elusive, yet that hasn't deterred the drive by the LGBT community to become part of the mainstream. Even in Charlotte, which hasn't always been welcoming to gay people, we now have two openly gay members of city council, and this city has been on the forefront of the fight for transgender rights. During this last week of Pride Month, we take a look at Charlotte's LGBT community, where it's been and where it's going. We're joined by Kimberly Melton, Executive Director of Charlotte Pride. Welcome to you. I'll get it right. I'm looking at the wrong side of the table.
Not a problem.
Melissa Morris is President of the Charlotte LGBT Chamber of Commerce. Good morning.
Good morning.
Joey Huell is a No-Daw business owner. He's been a salon owner for years, but now he's opened the No-Daw Company store. And he's among the first to marry in Mecklenburg County when North Carolina's marriage amendment was struck down. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
All three are in our studio, and with us by phone is Josh Burford, Assistant Director for Sexual and Gender Diversity at UNC Charlotte's Multicultural Resource Center. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome. There must be a delay. You are in Montgomery, Alabama this morning working. Prior to Orlando, which was the deadliest attack in America, and certainly the deadliest attack, I think, on the LGBT community in America. But prior to that was the 1973 arson of a place called the Upstairs Lounge, which I'd never known about until this weekend. It was a gay bar in New Orleans back in 73. News coverage was minimal. Politicians were silent on what happened. 32 people died in that incident, and they were the butt of jokes when they did so. No one made jokes in the aftermath of the Pulse shootings in Orlando. Politicians of all stripes decried that attack. News coverage was enormous. People around the country, straight and gay, got together in mourning and observances. What does that say about how far LGBT acceptance has come in the years between 1973 and 2016? What does that say? I'm not sure who should answer that question.
I mean, I think it says that we've, you know, gotten a lot of progress over the past 30 years, but there's obviously still a lot more to go. We have, kids in school that are still being bullied and picked on a daily basis. So, you know, Orlando is just another example of how much work we have to do. The great thing about our community is that, you know, we're fighters. We stand up and we, you know, thankfully at this point, I think we have a lot of straight allies, that's right, straight allies on our side that are fighting with us now. But Orlando is just another tragic example of how far we still have to go.
You said we are fighters. That wasn't always the case. What changed it?
I don't think it's that it wasn't always the case. I think that at some point the fear of persecution and harm started to outweigh our fear of not being out and not being ourselves. And so when you have instances where there are, you know, we're killed en masse and, you know, we're lost from our spaces, that we have to start standing up. We realize that we can't be silent anymore. We can't just be in the background anymore. And I think that we see that more and more. And the beautiful thing is that even though we're out and our voices are getting louder, our allies' voices are getting louder now too.
To quote that old movie Network, is it a case of being mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore?
Well, I think that's the case. But also, you know, we have large corporations who have now been accepting. I mean, Charlotte Pride is an annual event held in Charlotte. This year it's August 20th and 21st, and it's a weekend of festivities and parades and festivals. When we had a march in 1994, it was a Pride march, and there was no major corporations that were helping with that march. Now we have Wells Fargo and Bank of America that are supporting our parade and festivities.
This is Pride Month. Why is the Charlotte Pride weekend in August?
So many people want to go to so many Pride marches that we had to spread it out a little bit.
Yeah. You're in competition.
Yeah.
The aftermath of the Orlando shootings also saw a number of key conservative leaders express empathy for the LGBT community. Do you think that was sincere? And if so, what has led to that conversion?
I think that kind of – there's a lot of elements to that.
Paul Ryan talked about it.
I think unfortunately it takes, a lot of pain in a community for others who aren't in that community to kind of see what they're going through. Folks like Paul Ryan who have said some pretty terrible things about our community, I feel like I think now people can relate. They can understand the frustration. They when something like that happens, they look at their family and their friends and they think, this is a club. This is a place where people go to have a good time. This was not a demonstration. This was not, something that the gay community was putting in someone's face. It was they were having a great time with their friends and family and loved ones. And I think that, really hit a nerve, or I hope it did.
I'm wondering if you think this was a turning point. And I ask because, according to the New York Times, in the weeks leading up to this Orlando shooting, issues involving gays were boiling over in Congress. This is from the Times. And in Republican-controlled states around the country, more than 150 pieces of legislation were pending in state legislatures that would restrict rights or legal protections for sexual minorities. A Republican congressman, Rick Allen of Georgia, read a Bible verse from Romans that calls for the execution of gays. Congress was considering a bill that would allow individuals and businesses to refuse service to gay and lesbian couples. Gays, the Times reports, have surpassed Jews as the minority group most often targeted in hate crimes. That sounds like substantial resistance to the cause, to your cause, is it?
I think now it is not polite to be negative when it comes to a tragedy. I mean, so in this culture, it's just not polite. There are still people who are not in major corporations, who are in small and medium businesses, who still receive significant persecution. They can't be out. Or if they are, then their advancement is lessened in that company. So, yes, we at this table can be out and can be who we are. There's a lot of individuals who aren't. Mm-hmm. And those companies also may have on their books, we're LGBTQ friendly, but in reality, the practice is not.
Let's bring Josh into this conversation. He's sitting quietly on the phone in Alabama waiting to talk, and he's the Assistant Director for Sexual and Gender Diversity at UNC Charlotte's Multicultural Resource Center. Been on the program before, and I know, Josh, that one of the things that you do in your job is you are putting together or have put together a tremendous archive of kind of the history of gay activism, gay life, however you want to say it, in Charlotte. So put into context where we came from and where the city is today with regard to this topic.
Well, I want this to be a turning point. I mean, I want this to be a place where we can make significant change. I worry that what we're experiencing in Orlando is a part of a historical pattern. And so if you look at Stonewall, there was pressure. That pressure built on the most marginalized of our community, and then the pressure exploded into the riot. That was true in 66 when they had the Compton's Cafeteria riot. That was true in 59 with the Cooper's Donut Shop riot. And I think that what we're experiencing now is what happens when a community is leaned on very hard in a very specific way, and then the community has to push back. And so I hope it's a turning point, and I hope it's a turning point for the LGBT community to take a hard look at itself and what we have been focusing on politically for the last 25 years and what we need to be focusing on politically moving ahead for the next 25 years.
We hear a lot still from politicians and certain religious leaders about the so-called gay agenda. They're right. There is a gay agenda, isn't there?
Yeah, a whole bunch of people come together and believe in the same thing. I mean, I bet in this room we have three vastly separate ways to think about things. I have no concept. That's like saying the white male agenda. Mm-hmm. I mean,
but there is an agenda. Isn't the agenda fitting in, being equal, being treated equally? Isn't that the agenda? Isn't that what everybody wants?
Well, I wouldn't say the fitting in part, but I think that the equality piece is really the only agenda. And I think that should be everyone's agenda. It's just that we are specifically categorized in this marginalized space. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, the agenda at the end of the day is equality and peace, to be able to just live our lives and not be persecuted.
The other thing that that may be true for straight people, and particularly people on the right who have had trouble coming to terms with the progress that has been made in this area, is that the progress has seemed to be lightning fast. I mean, the marriage amendment happened like that in their minds. I'll bet you that's not how it seems to you.
Well, no. As a matter of fact, you know, Scott and I, my partner and I, have been together for 14 years. And last year, when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of marriage equality, was on June 26th, which just happened to coincide with June 26th in 2004. Scott and I went up to visit friends in New York and happened upon a huge parade celebration in Central Park, and we got married in New York on that day. Of course, it wasn't legal at that point, but that was 12 years to the day that we did that. And so, you know, I think for us, it seems like it's taken forever. And, you know, when you're talking to someone in our community, or really any community, minority really, that feels like they're being, you know, not given fair treatment, I don't think that any of us, or at least the people that I've spoken with, are trying to be accepted. And I think that's, you know, a main thing with, you know, the right is, you know, we have folks that'll come out and say, you know, we accept you. And it's like, well, we're not asking for permission to be accepted. We want to feel safe in our workplace. We want to, you know that every protection that every other American has, we have that same protection. And so I think what people need to realize is, you know, we're fighting for the exact rights, the exact equality that every other person in this country has.
But not special rights.
Not special rights at all.
Sometimes it's portrayed by people on the right as gay people wanting special rights.
Right. I would want to know specifically what rights they're referring to, because obviously being able to marry someone and having rights with that person, that's not a special right. Straight people get married every day. There's one thing.
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't think there's one right that we're asking for that nobody else gets.
And I know, Josh, you want to chime in on this, and I'll be happy to let you do it, but we only have 30 seconds. Can you do it in 30 seconds?
I will wait till we get back.
All right.
It's a longer thought than that.
You're bargaining on it. Okay. Josh Burford will talk about this in a moment. He's the Assistant Director of Sexual and Gender Diversity at UNC Charlotte's Multicultural Resource Center. Joey Hewell, Melissa Morris, and Kimberly Melton are gathered around our table. We'll take a break and come right back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Scott Clark Toyota, featuring rental cars, trucks, vans, and SUVs for weekend getaways, business trips, and special occasions. Located at 13,000 East Independence Boulevard, Toyota Rent a Car. Let's go places. Details at ScottClarkToyota.com. African Americans make up 35% of Charlotte's population, but represent 70% of the arrests. Nationwide, black drivers are stopped and searched more often than white. Minority children are more likely to be suspended from school than white students. Well, there's an initiative called Race Matters for Juvenile Justice that's been working in Charlotte to reduce these disparities, and we will learn about their successes and what's being done to ensure fairness in the justice system on this program tomorrow at 9.
on the next Diane Rehm Show. The world reacts to Brexit. European Union leaders plan for Great Britain's departure, and investors for more uncertainty as the U.S. considers economic and strategic implications.
Join that conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about LGBT rights and the struggle for those rights and where we are today, where we've come from, where that community feels it is going. Kimberly Melton is here, Executive Director of Charlotte Pride. Melissa Morris, President of the Charlotte LGBT Chamber. Joey Huell, an ODOT business owner. And Josh Burford, who is the Assistant Director of Sexual and Gender Diversity at UNC Charlotte's Multicultural Resource Center. He joins us by phone, and you wanted to chime in on the last topic we were talking about, and that was marriage and rights, etc.
Yeah, I think I have to respectfully disagree with my colleagues at the table that there is a consensus that everyone in the community is looking for an equality dialogue, because the radical queer and trans community is not interested in an equality dialogue. We feel like the systems that we are theoretically supposed to be included in are broken and slanted against so many different kinds of people. And so I think that from a radical perspective, what we're looking for is dismantling of systems that are based in racist white supremacy and that are looking, we want things that are looking at environmental justice for the poor. We want to look at immigration reform. And I myself am not interested in really being included in any of those systems because those systems are broken.
When you say the systems are broken, I mean, be more specific about that.
I mean, where would we even start? Like, our approach to the environment is completely broken. Our approach to immigration is broken. Our vastly violent culture, which targets primarily people of color and trans women of color specifically, is broken.
But these are things that have nothing whatsoever to do with sexual identity or gender identity, for that matter. These are big issues, broader issues that face everybody in the country, right?
I don't think so. I think that when you're talking about immigration, you're talking about queer and trans identified people because they are directly affected by deportation. I think if we're talking about class, we're talking about working class and poor people who are people of color and are trans people who are directly affected by these systems. So I think it, for me, and especially from a system, from looking at a systemic problem that we face in America, that you cannot separate these identities into tiny little chunks, because when you do, you overlook entire groups of people who don't have the capacity, economic or representation-wise, to speak for themselves. And so for me, environmental justice is a queer issue. It has to be if we're going to be able to do anything moving forward to help the people that are most at risk.
You keep an LGBTQ archive, Josh, at UNC Charlotte's Multicultural Resource Center. And earlier this year, I understand that you were granted access to the, this is almost shocking to have to say this, to the homosexual file from the Charlotte Observer. This file goes back to the 1950s. Before we talk about what you found in that file, when did the paper stop adding to it?
Well, so the file that they gave me access to, which I want to thank them, it was amazing, was a clippings file that they kept. And it was a way for their researchers to be able to go back when issues related to Charlotte came up that were related to LGBTQ identity so they could find it quickly. And they used a subject heading technique to sort of organize them that we would find kind of like off-putting in the 21st century. But it was very important. And so I think that they stopped clipping those files to put them in one particular spot when we switched to online cataloging for librarians. But that file exists. And it going back and looking at Charlotte's history through the lens of what was considered a, quote, homosexual issue is really fascinating stuff. I mean, it gives us a glimpse into who we were from a group of people who were chronicling us before we had the capacity to do that.
What was the purpose of the file? Why did they keep it?
I think it was important for them to keep it because, you know, as we would all agree, that there are certain, quote, hot-button issues that come up constantly throughout our cultural history, and sexual orientation and gender identity has been one of those since the 20s. And so it was important for them to have a quick access to go back and look at the patterns as they related to homosexual activity that came up through different parts of our history. So it was an important file for them to keep. And it wasn't so much like you would imagine sort of a McCarthy era file and like local troublesome homosexuals as it was an opportunity for them to keep in one spot everything about the community they could put their hands on nationally as well as locally, so they could make connections to give themselves an opportunity to do some really in-depth journalism.
So it was a sociological purpose, in other words.
In a way, yeah. But okay. It was archival as well as sociological, yeah.
Okay. It's never been easy for gay people to come out in most instances, and it's not a particularly Southern prohibition. It's all over the country. But here in Charlotte, Kimberly, you point out that it wasn't all that long ago that when the One Voice Gay Choir would perform, they would not list the singers' last names, just the last initial, and that's because a lot of them worked for major corporations and the banks in the city, and they felt it would hurt their careers if they were known. Was, in retrospect, in hindsight, was that a necessary precaution?
Absolutely. People have to eat, and you have to keep your jobs. And at that point, One Voice started around 1990. Not everybody was prohibited from putting their last name, but we did it in a way for solidarity, mm-hmm. so that no one felt left out. But those individuals couldn't, you know, they worked for banks and major corporations, and
but they weren't wearing masks. They were up there on the stage singing. They could be recognized. I mean,
right? But they could. The point was that they wouldn't necessarily be identified with their name, so that their employer it was a way in which you could keep your job. But now, you know, One Voice puts everybody's name and.
So what changed? What made that change? Because if they're working for the banks, suddenly NCNB became, Nations Bank became Bank of America, Wachovia became Wells Fargo, both have a West Coast, California, San Francisco presence. Is that what changed it?
In 1996, I know that there was a group of individuals who went to First Union and said, we need to form a gay alliance, and we need to change the rules that you have, and we need to have a gay presence in your HR system. And that, at least at First Union in 96, was what started the conversation. And it is our major institutions that start these conversations that trickle down.
But if I understand it correctly, they've gone from being talked into this to being one of the major drivers of this. Because if you look at the people who have come out in against HB2, for instance, among them are all these major banks and corporations.
Right.
What was in it for them to change? Why did they change?
Good, quality people. What you do in your own private life is your own private life. But if you are a good employee who has what that company needs, and it's been that way through our history. It's been that way through African-American history. It's the same thing. It's the major corporations that led and were forward-thinking enough to say it's the person who has the ability that counts, and not what color they are, not what their private life has.
And as that has opened doors, has it also opened eyes, minds, hearts?
Well, I think at this point, you know, the other issue to Kim's point is that we live in a truly global society now. So when you're looking for employees, you're not just looking in Charlotte for employees. They're bringing folks from all over the world. And so that idea of inclusiveness becomes much more important. And the relevancy of one's sexual orientation is very unnecessary. And I think what has happened because of that, folks who in the corporate world who wouldn't have been having conversations about LGBT issues now are not initially just forced to, but it becomes part of the mainstream. It becomes part of the, you know, if we're going to be inclusive, these are conversations that we really have to start having.
Your organization, Melissa, the Charlotte LGBT Chamber, up until, I don't know, 30 minutes ago, was called the Charlotte Business Guild.
Correct.
And now you've put your name on it. I mean, you put who you are on it, because for years it was an organization of gay business people who didn't put their name on it.
Yeah.
Why the change? Why now?
We came out. I mean, we like to joke that we came out. You know, when the Business Guild originated, it was much more of a social group for small business owners to be together, to have a space. And, you know, as that grew and as the necessity for these conversations and these strengths in business grew, you know, we really realized that again, we really have to come out if we're asking people to be out.
And you said it's good for business. Why is it good for business?
Well, again, I mean, this notion of visibly showing inclusion is really important. Just as individuals, you know, I always tell people if it's safe for you to be out, you should be out. You should be vocal so that others who cannot be out have that role model. And I think the same thing happens with business. We're seeing that now as all these businesses come forward in solidarity and support against HB2. It's not just good business sense for them that we're supporting our community. It's role modeling for other organizations who aren't quite there yet.
The Washington Post recently published an article with the headline, "Corporate America's Embrace of Gay Rights Has Reached a Stunning Tipping Point." And the article was about how business, especially big sports leagues, were exerting influence on states over proposed laws that would affect the LGBT community. And it pointed out that the change in support for LGBT causes has shifted so dramatically that the risks of speaking out have been superseded by the risks of not doing so. Does that support surprise you, particularly from major sports leagues? I mean, even the NBA is still toying with removing the NBA All-Star game from Charlotte because of HB2. They're talking about this when sports leagues are still among the more homophobic environments around, aren't they? Does it surprise you?
Well, I think that goes to the point of how relevant this issue is and how people have had enough. Right. And people realize that you cannot continue to discriminate against any particular group. And again, it's not just good for business. It's, you know, when you have someone like the NBA, the NFL standing in solidarity and saying we're willing to move our All-Star game.
Yeah.
That's already planned to be here in just, I mean, less than a year at this point. That says a lot.
Josh, put that into perspective from your point of view.
Well, I think it's interesting that like the very first LGBT professional group was organized within the American Library Association in the 70s. And so librarians have always been a little bit, I mean, I could say that because I'm a librarian, but have always been a little bit more, you know, forward thinking than a lot of places because of their access to information. And so I think what's interesting about this is that when we took coming out from a national conversation and made it, to Melissa's point, a local conversation, that's when I think things changed, because I've said this a million times, it's easy to hate in the abstract. It's hard to hate the person who's sitting at the desk across from you. And so we've made it into a good business decision for a lot of people to support us, not because we're a giant voting block of people spending money, but because we are their colleagues and coworkers and the people that they, you know, we work more than we do anything. So we're sharing that space with them, potentially more than some of their loved ones. And knowing us in that way has made this change happen. And I think that's a really good, important point for people to remember, that we are in every single aspect of every person's life all the time.
But that's always been the case. That's always been the case. And there were in the 1940s, 30s, 20s, 50s, 60s, right until recently, it was very dangerous to reveal that about yourself to your colleagues, to your friends, because you either would have been ostracized or fired or worse. So where was it? How did it happen? When? Where did the urge to say, "Look, this is enough. We're going to do this. We're going to be brave. We're going to put it in your face and say, this is who we are. If you don't like it, deal with it." Where did that start? What was the moment? Is there a moment?
I don't think there's one specific thing. It's small steps that, much like Melissa said, that one person said, "Okay, I can't take it anymore. I'm going to be out. I'm going to be the presence. I'm going to let the youth that we work with see that it's okay. I'm going to be strong for them. I'm going to be the voice for them." And that's what, and taking that, you know, using one voice as an example, you know, there was no names and now there are names. It's a small step, because each step brings more and more people with you.
As you said, Joey, you and your partner got married, 12 years before it became legal to be married. What was that step like? I mean, that's a pretty out, brave,
in-your-face
thing to do.
Well, you know, I think that was, I don't think we thought about it, you know, then in 2004, but I think that's really when we both decided that we were going to be brave, that we were going to talk to people about this, that we were going to, you know, the people that we met and the people that we continue to meet who are opposed to it. It's, you know, like you said, once you, you know, are in their face and you're sitting down at the table with them and they realize, you know, this is a normal human being that just wants a normal life. They want to feel safe and protected. To hit on the point that we were talking about, when did the ball start rolling? I think a big step for our community was social media. I think that, you know, when Facebook and even MySpace came along, and, you know, there are kids and teenagers in these small, you know, remote towns. Now they have internet. Now they can socialize with people who are like them. They can talk to people that are role models to them. They, you know, have something to look at. They're not just, you know, stuck in this hole and feel like they're trapped and alone. And I think that social media played a really huge part in making people feel brave enough to say, you know, I can come out. There are people like me. There are people that I can, you know, once I'm done with this small area, I can move to an area that I'm accepted and loved, and, you know, I don't have to, you know, feel scared for myself when I'm going out in public.
Go ahead.
You, Mike, you talked about then and now. Mm-hmm. I worked the switchboard in the 90s. So one lone room, two phones, you know, people could call in from all over the state. And the one
call, the gay
lesbian switchboard.
Yes.
And it was, you know, we published this 1-800 number and anybody could call. And the one call that to this day I remember, this woman was 55 years old. This is before caller ID, so I had no idea where she was calling from. She wouldn't even tell me the town she was in because, you know, we had a little check marks as to where people call from. She goes, I don't feel comfortable doing that. I said, no problem. She said, I've raised my children. I've been with my husband for over 25 years, and I know I'm a lesbian, and there's nobody I can talk to. What am I supposed to do? And I said, well, you know, have you found a therapist? At that time, Charlotte didn't even have a gay lesbian bookstore. We had to drive to Greensboro if you wanted books. And this is before Amazon for the young people. So there was no other place to get them unless you got them at a bookstore. Mm-hmm. And so I knew of the bookstores up in her. And I said, are you in the eastern side of North Carolina? And that's all she would say. And I'd say, well, if you go to Raleigh, da-da-da, here's where you go, here's where you go. And I said, why don't you start with books? To speak to your point, you were totally isolated.
Talk about that. I don't think people understand. I don't think straight people can even understand that. What talk about what that isolation, that social isolation, not knowing that you knew something was different about you. You didn't know anybody else that had similar feelings or thoughts. Nobody to talk to, and particularly if you're young, no one to role model after. What was the, I'm not even sure the right word to use, but how did that impact people?
I think that isolation and invisibility have been like the two key components of the last 100 years when you look at the community. Like I know growing up in a mostly rural part of Alabama as a young person, like I actually was able to see, I was fortunate to have an uncle and his partner who were out, but I was able to at least see what other gay people might look like.
I want to come back to that, Josh. We have to take a break. I want to come back to that and let you finish your thought in a minute. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center's 4th of July celebration featuring live music from the Wood Brothers, Dr. Dog, and fireworks on July 3rd and 4th. Details at usnwc.org. The world reacts to Brexit. European Union leaders plan for Great Britain's departure and investors brace for more uncertainty as the U.S. considers economic and strategic implications of the vote. All of that coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Reem Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you're welcome to do so. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. And we're coming right back.
Britain's out. Americans, say what? I just know that there was a vote taken this week, and apparently they're leaving.
I saw it on the news this morning, and I'm glad. When countries start giving up their sovereignty, you know, it's dangerous.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Now, what do we do? That's next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about Charlotte's LGBT community, where it's been, where it's going, how things are today in light of the end of Pride Month and also the Orlando shootings. Melissa Morris is with us, president of the Charlotte LGBT Chamber of Commerce. Kimberly Melton, executive director of Charlotte Pride. Joey Huell, who is a longtime business owner in the Charlotte area. Josh Burford, assistant director of sexual and gender diversity at UNC Charlotte's Multicultural Resource Center. We were talking about the social isolation, particularly prior to the internet and social media, that people experienced where they thought they were living in small towns. They knew they were different. They knew that that difference would have a severely negative impact on them if they even tried to ask questions about that difference, and they had nowhere to turn to. And you were talking about that. And the word I was looking for, I think, Josh, was the pathology of it. What does that do to somebody, and what has the ability to say, this is who I am, done for that pathology?
Well, and I think that was the strength of coming out in the 70s as a political act, was that we felt as a community that there was something wrong with us internally, and then externally we were being affirmed of that belief. And so people told us there was something wrong with us. And so to come out was that moment to say, you know what, in spite of all of this, I want to figure out what this human being is going to look like as a fully realized person. And then when we came out and formed community, we began to fight against that pathology. What I think is really interesting about the 21st century is that even though we have social media and technology and all these ways to connect, you still see, this is what we see at UNC Charlotte, you know, 18, 19-year-old students from small towns in North and South Carolina who still feel isolated despite the fact that they have these greater options. And I think that you're right, that overcoming that pathology is something that we continue to struggle with.
The mainstream media, movies, even television, have long portrayed gays and lesbians as people who were outcast, very dangerous. They led sad, lonely lives. And that was probably true for a lot of people in the 30s and 40s and 50s when it was dangerous to come out. You lived in constant fear. So how was that image dispelled and replaced? How did that happen?
I still think there are times when, you know, it can be really, really dangerous. I mean, obviously with Pulse in Orlando, you know, even last year when Scott and I went to the courthouse to get married, you know, we were being interviewed by TV stations, you know, all around Charlotte. And it didn't occur to me at the time until they released the decision after 5 o'clock on that Friday. And so in Charlotte, it had already closed. And so we had to come Monday morning mm-hmm. to get married. And of course, there was a big line of people that were, you know, waiting to get married as well. But for us, you know, it was that Monday morning I was getting ready, and it just occurred to me at that point. It's like, you know, we've been on TV. We've, you know, been very vocal about, you know, marriage equality and how important it is. And just, you know, for, you know, our gay brothers and sisters to be able to come out and feel comfortable. And, you know, it's like they knew where we were. They, you know, if somebody wanted to do something, they could have obviously done it. And it didn't occur to me until that point that, you know, they know we're going to be at the courthouse. They know there are cameras there. And these people, you know, a lot of them, they, you know, want to be famous in a way. And so they want to get their name out there and their image out there. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, attack people. And I just didn't, you know, that Monday morning was the first time that I thought this could actually be dangerous for this many people to gather together.
What has it meant to you to be able to be married, legally married, and enjoy the same kinds of protections, legal protections that straight couples have always had access to?
Well, you know, I don't think, you know, for me specifically, it was never you know, an interest of mine to point fingers and, you know, and say, see, we have this now. It was really, you know, the feeling of comfort, the feeling of knowing that, you know, if anything happened to either of us, that we would have, you know, rights to one another. If he was in the hospital, if I were in the hospital, that, you know, we had the the ability legally to make decisions for the other. And I think that's a, you know, unfortunately a very scary thing. And I think it's happened to hundreds of couples. I mean, we, up until that decision came down, we heard stories, you know, on a weekly basis of a couple that's been together for 60 years and never had legal rights to one another. One passes away, the other one, you know, their family didn't agree with the relationship. And so they're, you know, taking all they have. They're taking their house and their car and, you know, everything. And that, you know, the person that survived is still, you know, sitting there, and they have nothing, and they have no legal right to do anything. And so I think that was probably the biggest thing for us, is just the comfort of knowing that no matter what happens, we are, you know, legally joined together.
But let's remember that if you have children, there is, the legality is out the window in this state. I mean, the birth mother has all the rights. The other mother does not have any rights now.
And that's still the case.
And that's still the case. So,
and that's what we're really fighting for. You know, that's the thing, is I think, you know, as the ball continues to roll, and over the past 10 years, I really feel like it's, you know, picked up. But, you know, there are a lot of things that we need to change. And we were talking about equality for all kinds of minorities. And I do agree with him that, you know, we can, you know, we should be focused on a lot of other areas. But right now, I think it's a matter of chipping away at the stereotypes and making sure that, you know, we have equality and that we have, you know, a say in this. And then once we get that, I think we can work on other aspects too. I mean, I think there are a lot of things that we can help with.
Yeah, and it's also our allies. I mean, to speak to the point of going back to the young people who may be alone, if they have allies in the community, non-gay allies that say, oh, this is cool, whatever, you know, fine, you're who? Okay, fine, no problem, we don't care. That speaks to that. I mean, the festival and parade weekend with Charlotte Pride, like, if in, let's see, 13, there was about 80,000 people that came for the weekend. In 14, there was about 100,000. And last year, there was about 120,000 over the course of the weekend. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of allies too. I mean, it's wonderful, and it's a celebratory thing. You're out there, those kids, those young kids who can make it, they're feeling, wow, I feel love.
Well, and I think to going back to the point of having this, you know, social media, and you get to see that there are others like you, the flip side to that is that social media and the news is not also showing how much hate is out there. And so these young kids are still getting these messages. Now, en masse, it wasn't just, you know, friends at school passing notes, oh, you're gay, something's wrong with you. Now you have, you know, hundreds, maybe thousands of kids or other, or adults even, that are bullying these kids, and they see these images on the news. You know, you see this Orlando shooting, and it's, you know, this is supposed to be our safe space, and someone is willing to come in and just kill us because who we are. I think that's another piece, you know, that goes back to this issue of support and the work that still has to be done.
What's the origin of that hate?
I think difference is always the origin of hate.
The other.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like when people, you know, when people struggle, whether that's with, you know, the financial situation or whatever burden they may have, I think it's easy for them to blame others and to look at others and say, well, I'm better than them, or I, you know, whatever the case may be. I think that, you know, unfortunately, even politicians and religious leaders at this point are pointing fingers at the gay community and, you know, saying that we're the cause of a lot of the heartache that a lot of this country, you know, a lot of this country feels like they don't have a voice. And that's straight, gay, black, white, that's everyone. But I think that there are a lot of people who, instead of, you know, wanting to fix it and speaking up, I think that it's easier just to sit back and point fingers and to blame. And so I think with that, it comes hate. And they, you know, they grew up in households. I mean, I grew up in a household, unfortunately, that, you know, I heard words that you know, directly affected me. And at this point, obviously, my family is very accepting and very loving, but that certainly wasn't the case
when they were throwing those words around. Did they know about you?
Oh, not at all. I was terrified. And that's, you know, that's the thing, is that's the same with businesses, is, you know, I think that, you know, my family just wasn't educated,
right.
And nor was I. I mean, I grew up in an area that there were no gay people in my high school, at least that were out. And so, you know, once I came out and, you know, my family at first, I think, you know, I had some family members that knew that were like, yeah, I've always known. And there were some that didn't want to ever talk to me again. Now, every single one of them, they know Scott. They know, you know, what we do, we try to do for our community. And I think that that education goes a long way. So I think hate is a lack of education, really.
Tom in York, South Carolina asks, is anyone working with a clergy outreach type program to help stop the hate where a lot of it begins?
I would go with MECMAN. They do incredible work. In fact, they held one of the vigils, one of the many vigils that were held. It was held at St. Peter's Church, and they orchestrated that. That's who I would go to for that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. James in Huntersville, as a guy dating a transgendered woman, I'm always surprised how many people have told me how brave I am, and it makes me mad and upset. I don't personally understand what I could possibly fear by having been with someone who makes me happy. She's the brave one, and if someone has a problem with who I've chosen to spend my life with, then I don't want them in my life.
Yeah, I mean, that's beautiful. But I think that there's some reality there that as dating a transgender woman, that there are people who sometimes want to harm her just because of who she is. So there are some realities there. I mean, they are both brave as a couple, but...
Yeah, I mean, we have in the transgender community alone, there's an alarmingly high rate of suicides taking place.
Yeah.
And, you know, back to your, you know, your point about social media is, you know, while we can reach out to them and that, you know, hopefully they have a community that they feel safe in, even if that's just on the internet, on Facebook or wherever, you know, with that, there's still an alarmingly high rate. And that's where I get so upset with, you know, where I think that they're, politicians try to push an agenda and perhaps it's to get votes or whatever it is. It's, you know, you're really affecting people. People are hearing this, you know, who feel like they're trapped. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, some of them, you know, don't make it out of that. They don't, you know, make it to adulthood where they can get out and meet folks and really feel safe and comfortable in their own skin.
A recent survey by the Public Religion Research Institute finds that 71% of Americans support laws that would protect lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people from discrimination in jobs, housing, and public accommodations. That's the Public Religion Research mm-hmm. Institute. The Pew Research Center recently found that 55% of Americans and 70% of millennials support same-sex marriage. That has to encourage you. How has that happened so quickly?
Well, again, I think as we have these conversations and we are starting to dispel who the other really is, that, you know, it just kind of grows from there. And, you know, even from a business perspective, again, I mean, the Business Guild moving into changing their name to the LGBT Chamber of Commerce, that idea of, you know, fully being inclusive and showing that this is important in business and beyond, it breaks down that issue of the other. We're not another kind of business.
And yet, in spite of all these major businesses saying HB2 is bad for us and being inclusive with LGBTQ people in their own businesses. In May, your chamber, the LGBT chamber, was reviewing its affiliation with the Charlotte Chamber of Commerce because they issued a statement earlier that month that said in part that they were increasingly concerned about growing economic losses and damaging reputational risk to Charlotte and North Carolina resulting from HB2. And they thought that the city ought to reconsider its non-discrimination policies and repeal them.
Right.
Where have you gone with that?
Well, you know, I think that was important for us. Our chamber does not do political advocacy specifically. The Charlotte General Chamber certainly does. But it was important for us to say that, you know, we are supportive of full equality. You know, Charlotte did the right thing. Charlotte City Council did the right thing in trying to protect all of its citizens and create laws that protected everyone. So to then ask them to go back, rescind a law that is no longer valid because of HB2, so that hopefully the General Assembly would do something unknown to anyone was problematic.
Everybody focuses on the bathroom and locker room parts
sure.
of HB2. No one really talks about the clause in there that prohibits individuals from suing in state court
yes.
if they feel they've been discriminated against in the workplace. And even Governor McCrory would like the legislature to go back and reconsider that part of the law. How commonplace is discrimination in the workplace today?
This is a right to work state. You can get fired for anything.
Right. And the challenge.
You're saying that it happens.
Oh yeah, sure, absolutely.
And but the challenge is that you don't have a legal right to bring forth a discrimination case, there's no way to track discrimination. So you have this evolving cycle that there's nothing on record that says that there's all these cases of discrimination because I can't bring that case forward because it's not legal for me to do so. So, you know, it certainly happens. We know about it, but tracking it is almost impossible.
Beth in Salisbury, who identifies herself as the president of Salisbury Pride, says it's interesting listening to your conversation this morning as we just finished the 6th Salisbury Pride in our small town. When we started 6 years ago with our first festival, we expected 500 people, over 2,500 people showed up, showing us there was a strong need for a safe place for the LGBTQ community to come and celebrate who they were. This past weekend, we had over 4,000 people come to celebrate who they are. We still had protesters and haters, but the overwhelming feeling at our festival was one of inclusion and love. We've talked about in the course of this hour that as the gay community came together, it came together in cloistered environments for the longest time in gay bars and clubs, places where people of like mind and like sexuality could come together and feel absolutely safe in all of this. Gay business organizations like the Charlotte Business Guild, now the LGBT Chamber, were places where fellow travelers could come together in safety, be themselves, discuss what was important to them in this environment. As acceptance becomes more common, do you worry that these places where you come together because you are unique, the need for that will go away and that you'll become less of a community?
No, I think the need will always be there. We'll just have allies along with us.
Scott?
And I think that these places will continue to be relevant. Their relevancy will just change and evolve depending on what the community needs, but they'll never go away.
I called you by your partner's name, Joey. Joey, quickly.
That's all right. No, I don't think they'll ever go away. I think we always love to see friends and family together.
Thank you all.
Agreed.
Good. Thank you all for the hour, because we're out of time. Thank you.